It has been an issue for quite a number of years, and some angry homeowners say that right now it's completely out of hand. But if you talk with animal rights advocates, well, they have a different view. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're glad you can be part of the program today, and today's program is one that, let's say, inspires passion from both sides of the issue. I'm talking about the deer population in our region. There are parts of Long Island where the population is said to have reached alarming levels, and in Connecticut, the deer have, in some cases, wandered all the way down to the Post Road. And if you live in Connecticut, you know that some homeowners around here have actually fenced in their properties, which upsets their neighbors. So what should be done? What's the answer? Are lethal methods appropriate, or are they inhumane and unethical? We have a number of guests today, but we need to hear from you. What are your ideas? What are your solutions? Maybe your gripes. Our email is tfs@wshu.org. And you can leave us a message on Twitter or Facebook. Find us at Full Story WSHU. And of course, our voicemail is always open for you. 833-CALL-TFS. That's 833-225-5837. We have a number of guests that'll be joining us today. But for the first portion of our program, we're going to narrow the focus, if you will. And we're going to be talking about the island and Fire Island. And we're bringing in Johanna Hamburger, who's an attorney with the Animal Welfare Institute. It's a nonprofit. It's been around a long time, since 1951. Johanna, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ron. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a contentious issue. And as I said in my introduction, there's passion on both sides, obviously. Tell us about Fire Island and what is going on there now.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. So just to give a little bit of background, the Fire Island National Seashore, which is managed by the National Park Service, is located in Suffolk County, and it was established to preserve a little over 19,000 acres of land that comprises beaches, sand dunes, and a variety of other unique natural features. And so currently, about over 400 deer live within Fire Island. And in 2016, the National Park Service adopted a deer and vegetation management plan. And that plan called for reducing the deer population through a combination of sharpshooting by government agents, as well as public hunting and capture and euthanasia. And so the reason that National Park Service decided to adopt that plan was based on concerns over the impact to vegetation within that National Park Service unit. So they had concerns that the vegetation was reduced in biodiversity, that it wasn't as productive, and that there were just negative impacts that caused concern. And I certainly agree that vegetation harms are very important and a concern for the Park Service. Our concern, though, was that the National Park Service really jumped to the conclusion that it was the deer and only the deer that were impacting vegetation negatively within this Fire Island National Seashore. And so that concern was what sparked our litigation in 2017. And the real fundamental basis of that litigation is to ensure that our government is adhering to the laws that it is required to adhere to and are governed by.
So if I can read between the lines from what you're saying, it sounds as if it's not just the deer, but you're saying that we humans are damaging the vegetation.
That certainly could be one component. And so one claim that we have and that we brought in this litigation was under the National Environmental Policy Act. And basically what that act requires any federal government agency to do is to consider the impact of its actions on the environment and to collect as much detailed scientific information as it can so that it is making good decisions and decisions that are based on complete scientific information. And our concern is partially that they only considered the impact of deer. And like you said, They didn't consider the impact of, one, for example, humans who are still allowed to collect vegetation within that unit of management within Fire Island. They also didn't consider other factors such as invasive species, which are known to be a significant concern in reducing the biodiversity within that region. They also didn't consider plant disease or other issues such as soil quality, water quality, and storm surges, which also have impacts on vegetation and which we think that they should have considered under the National Environmental Policy Act.
For those who haven't been to Fire Island, and I went there many years ago, it's stunning. It's absolutely gorgeous. Give us, like I said, for those who haven't been there, tell us the size of Fire Island and the area that we're talking about.
Absolutely. So it's a little over 19,000 acres, and it encompasses a very diverse environment. So it encompasses not only beaches and a really elaborate sand dune complex, but it also contains one of the only remaining holly reserves, which is a type of holly forest that's left within the United States. It also contains the William Floyd Estate, and so that is a historic estate that contains a beautiful property and surrounding lands that the National Park Service is trying to manage in a way that preserves the natural environment of that area.
I have to tell our listeners, we already have a number of emails and messages to our Twitter account. I will be getting to them a little bit later on in the program. Just can't do it right now because we're pressed for time with Johanna. She's only with us for this first segment. Johanna, there are 400 deer right now that we're talking about. What is it that the National Park Service would like to reduce the amount to?
Right. So they're trying to reduce the number to about 20 to 25 deer per acre. So, for example, within the William Floyd Estate, which is where a recent cull was conducted, that land contained it's estimated to be about 140 deer or around there. And so the goal was to kill over 100 deer in order to get that number down to the 20 to 25 deer per acre that is the articulated goal within that deer and vegetation management plan.
And I'm sorry, just so I could understand, you said there was a recent hunt. How long ago did that take place?
So it wasn't a hunt. It was a cull.
It was a cull.
So I'll get to, right, no, and I'll get to that distinction in a minute because it's a sort of fine line. But so that was set to start, and this sort of gets into our litigation, but that was set to start on February 25th. And so we believe that that likely has started, though we don't have information on whether that cull was completed as the National Park Service intended, and if it was completed, how many deer were actually killed. So we're still waiting on that information, but it is something that we believe the National Park Service went forward with as stated in some press releases that they put out.
Do me a favor and clarify that for me. What's the difference between a cull and a hunt?
Absolutely. So a cull is when a federal unit of management, in this case the Park Service, brings in sharpshooters from the Wildlife Services, which is a federal agency that's housed within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so those sharpshooters are, again, federal agents that go in and specifically target a certain number of deer and implement that cull over a series of a day or a couple of days. And that's in contrast to a public hunt, where members of the public are invited in and permitted pursuant to regulation to engage in hunting activity within a federally managed unit of land.
So you're not sure right now from what you're saying whether or not it sounds like it took place or is taking place, but you're starting to or trying to stop anything from going forward in the future?
So it's sort of. So just to give you a little bit of context, so this management plan is supposed to proceed in three different phases of lethal culls. So the first phase was set to begin this winter, and that's the phase that I was just talking about, phase one that we believe has already been implemented. Phase two is set to start in 2020, and phase three is set to start in 2021, which is all dependent upon whether or not the agency has funding to conduct these activities. And so what we tried to do was through a temporary restraining order, which was part of the litigation that we had brought earlier. We tried to get the court to stop the agency from moving forward with phase one, which, like I said, was scheduled to go forward on February 25th. And so we succeeded in getting a temporary restraining order, which meant that the court stopped the call from going forward until she could review the merits of our motion for preliminary injunction. And ultimately, she decided to deny the motion for preliminary injunction and not intervene to proactively stop or prevent the Park Service from implementing phase one. And so where that leaves us is we have to continue with the remainder of the litigation. And so we're moving forward on our three claims, and we are trying to get a resolution on the merits so that we can stop the lethal management aspect of the plan. So as you were saying before, that we would stop phase two and phase three from going forward.
It's a complex issue, Johanna.
I
appreciate you coming on. I'd like to invite you to come back at some point in the future and we could revisit this issue. Thank you, Johanna.
Thank you very much, Ron.
Johanna Hamburger, an attorney with Animal Welfare Institute. We're talking about the deer population on Long Island in our region in Connecticut. This is The Full Story. It's The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Ron Ropiak, and we're talking about the deer in our region, and I have to tell you, we have a number of comments already by email and on Twitter. I want to read, as I start this segment, I want to get to one of the emails right off the top. It's from Barry, and he's over in Sayville, and he writes, "Hey, Ron, I live along a freshwater estuary in Sayville, been here for 25-plus years, all types of waterfowl, possum, raccoon, red fox. However, the newest common visitor are the deer, and they're highly destructive to the flora locally in that they munch down anything of beauty. It's a very suburban area, therefore hunting is at best next to impossible. I have no answer, but at this rate, there will be no other plants available for forage from other species." Barry, thank you. I appreciate you writing in. Let me get to some of our guests right now. We have a number of them for the rest of our program, and we'll get to them at one point or another, and I ask those who I don't get to right at the top, please be patient. Andrew Labonte is joining us. He's a wildlife biologist at DEEP, Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How many deer are there in Connecticut?
Well, we've been kind of on the decline here in Connecticut since around 2008, 2009, where we peaked at maybe about 150,000 deer in the state, and currently we estimate there's probably somewhere around the neighborhood of 100,000 deer.
Are there any specific areas?
We have different deer management zones across the state. There's 13 different zones. Along the shoreline towns is what we call deer management zone 11, and then our deer management zone 12, and then over in Fairfield County, closer to you folks, would be zone 11.
Okay, so there are 100,000 deer in Connecticut now. Is there a number that the state would like that number to get to?
We don't have a specific number. It's more on a regional basis where we try to keep the deer population somewhere around 20 deer per square mile.
And how do you get to that number? What are the methods?
Obviously, the most widespread methods are through hunting. And occasionally in certain areas, there's more what you would call like a culling activity.
And how long has the state been doing that? Or is that done basically on a town-by-town basis?
Not so much on a town-by-town basis. Sometimes it's on individual landowner basis. Large landowners like water companies have us put together a plan to reduce deer numbers, because obviously they can have an impact on forest regeneration, soil runoff, things like that around the reservoir, and create problems with the drinking water itself.
So the number is down in Connecticut, but I know, I've lived in the state now, close to 40 years, that some people just get so upset when they have deer come onto their property. And I know others who say, you know what, this is fantastic because it makes it feel suburban. It makes it feel rural. It's trying to balance that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a difficult balance. Obviously, as Connecticut becomes more and more urbanized, it creates less and less space for the native deer to obviously utilize, but they certainly love the ornamental planting. So when you do drop in those houses alongside those tiny woodlots, it tends to attract the deer to the local neighborhoods where they can feed on a lot of succulent vegetation in a short period of time. So it's a difficult balance when you enjoy seeing them at the beginning, and then over the winter, all of a sudden, come spring, you have nothing left and there's no foliage left out there on the landscape. You might have a different opinion of the deer population.
I have to tell you a personal story. A few years ago, I came home and in my driveway, and I know the number was exact because they had no fear. I pulled into my driveway and there were 15 deer in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there in my car and they just kind of looked at me, you know, like, what do you want? What are you doing here? And I sat there and I counted them and I slowly pulled forward and then they slowly ran away. But it seems that they don't have much of a, I don't know if fear is the right word, but they've certainly become used to us humans.
Certainly that is the case. Oftentimes in areas like Fairfield County and those shoreline towns, because there's not an awful lot of area that can be firearms hunted, so folks aren't out there with guns shooting at deer. It's typically done very quietly with the use of a bow and arrow because you can get much closer into urban areas. So the deer really have no fear of humans. Obviously, we're pretty much hand-feeding them by planting stuff out in the yard for them year-round, and when they eat it all one year, we turn around and replant it the next year. And there's not a lot of concern. Folks might think, you know, putting out some kind of motion-activated lights might scare the deer at night. It might happen the first time, but they just begin to become accustomed to the light coming on and no negative effect associated with it. So they do, over time, become more and more friendly to the point where they're out in the middle of the day feeding in your yard and they're not bothered by you.
Trust me on this. Flashlights and bright lights, they don't make a difference. Andrew, stay with us. Laura Simon is joining us also. She's a wildlife ecology consultant, formerly with the Humane Society. Laura, it almost sounds, from what Andrew was saying, you know, humans are a good chunk of this problem. We plant the things that they like, and so they're coming to eat.
It's a huge problem. And yes, you're right. We plant a buffet. And so then we're angry at the deer for coming to it. But the good news is that we can reverse that problem. And what we try and do is teach people how to deter deer. If you live in suburbia, you don't want hunters in your backyard shooting at deer. That is a safety issue. That is not something you want. But you can switch what you plant. For example, if you live in deer country, you may not be able to have tulips, but you can have a beautiful array of marigolds and daffodils and all kinds of flowers that are equally beautiful but are deer resistant, or more deer resistant than some of the varieties that people plant now. You can also use some repellents. Some are more effective than others. The ones that have that rotten egg-based basis seem to deter deer more. And there is some barriers that you can create. There's a number of things you can do to deter deer, and I'm an avid gardener. I will not live without impatiens, which I love, but deer love. And I found ways to protect my garden, and so the deer can exist, and so can I, and I can enjoy my flowers. So there are many things people can do, but it's really misleading to say that hunting and reducing deer numbers is going to reduce the problems people have in suburbia, because quite frankly, if you grow, you know, a few roses, you're going to have deer coming to your yard because that is the Häagen-Dazs. That's a chocolate chip cookie of the deer world. And so what we need to teach people is how do you protect what you value? How do you deter deer? And there's a toolbox we have for helping people to do that.
Laura, along those lines, let me read you a tweet that we got from Eric from Noank, who wrote in, "I can't understand people who oppose culling of white-tailed deer. They are so destructive when unchecked, leading to the loss of woodland biodiversity and habitat destruction for so many other animals."
Mm-hmm. Well, here's an interesting thing. I'm a graduate of the Yale School of Forestry, and we looked at this issue. And quite frankly, deer do browse. They need to eat. But people tend to assume that deer are destroying the habitat, and quite frankly, we are having far more of an impact on biodiversity than deer ever will. Deer do impact the growth of some species, but they also help the growth of others. And we're seeing that there are certain kinds of plants that deer actually will browse to the benefit of other species. But what we really need to look at is what is the source of the problem. I mean, people will say, oh, deer are having this huge effect. They're impeding oak regeneration. But when you look at the situation carefully, you see that there's a number of other issues. There's a number of insect species and a number of other predators, seed predators, that are impacting the growth of oak. So it's not a situation where deer are the sole cause of the problem, but people tend to assume it because they see deer and they see the kind of impact they don't like. But we need to remember that forests don't stay the same. I mean, there's something called succession, where forests go from an early growth stage with a lot of biodiversity to a more advanced mature stage where the tall trees overshadow and cut out the sun for the slower growing species. So, you know, forests by nature become less biodiverse. So if we don't like that, we have to manage forests differently to create an early stage of succession if we want a lot of biodiversity. But we can't blame everything on deer because deer are not the only factor out there influencing forest growth. And people tend to come up with wrong assumptions about that.
Scott Williams, I know you're still with us. Please be patient. I'll get to you in just a moment. I want to bring in Mike Tessitore, who is with the group, and the title says it all, Hunters for Deer. Mike, thanks for being with us. Mike, are you there?
Hey, thanks a lot, Ron. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Excellent, sir.
How many members do you have in Hunters for Deer?
We have about 100 certified bow hunters in our group.
And you're out on the island?
We're home-based out of East Quag.
And how long have you been hunting deer?
I mean, personally, I've been hunting since I was about 18, so about almost 30 years. The group has been together since 2013. We started our management program back then when we saw a need for property owners wanting hunters that they can trust and, you know, feel as though they were accountable. So what we did is we created a program where we put our hunters through a bow hunting in sensitive environments course, a proficiency test, and we did background investigations on them.
You consider yourself a conservationist, don't you?
Absolutely.
You know there are some animal.
I
was going to say there are some animal rights advocates who are hearing that saying, you know what? I don't get that.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't get when animal activists, the only thing they do for conservation is put up billboards to attract more donors instead of putting money into programs. You know, and it's also funny to hear animal activists talk about an overpopulation of one species while ignoring the other ones that are affected by it. You know, environmental conservation is a Jenga puzzle piece. And, you know, back to Barry in Sayville that says, you know, he'd like to have, you know, hunting as an option. You know, in New York State, it's the property owner's right to choose how to deal with nuisance animals. And, you know, we lobbied very hard in 2014 to get the bow hunting setback reduced to 150 feet instead of the 500-foot setback. And that's what has essentially made bow hunting very effective for residential and suburban areas.
I'm going to bring in Scott Williams now. But, Scott, right before I get to you, I want to ask you to respond to this email that just came in from Heidi from Southampton. She writes, "The owner of a fashion boutique on Main Street, busy at her desk, saw something walking by, perhaps the dog whose owner was nearby. Then all hell broke loose, splintering glass, trashing about in one of the changing booths. A buck somehow had entered, scared to death at his reflection. He had a panic attack, ran out of the store without buying anything, and disappeared. I think calling, Heidi writes, birth control ingested through skin or food in feeding stations has to be done. What do you think, Scott?
When you have a situation like that, clearly you have an overabundant deer situation with deer being in places that they shouldn't, like running through storefronts and so forth, and they usually don't survive that very well. As far as deer, she's suggesting deer management and looking for alternatives, birth control. They've been looking at various drugs to prevent that for about 40 years now, and they have limited effectiveness to the tune where people are now doing surgical sterilizations, which can be very costly for the animal as well, but it's much less controversial than culling. Also, what's been looked at is a combination of non-lethal and lethal. So when animals are overabundant, say 40 or 50 animals in a herd are captured and sterilized, and then everything else around it is killed, which people still have deer they can see, but it takes a while for the population to rebound thereafter.
I should mention also, and I didn't mean to be rude, that Scott Williams is an associate scientist and certified wildlife biologist at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station's Department of Forestry and Horticulture. Scott, is the situation with deer, at least in Connecticut, getting better or worse, in your opinion?
As Andy said, they were about 10 years ago, they were at the peak, and they've been coming down. There are still pockets where deer overabundance exists, and you have people and landscape damage and issues, but also you have public health concerns with collisions with vehicles. Collisions with motorcycles often turn to be fatal for the occupant of the motorcycle, which is an unfortunate situation. And you have tick and tick-borne disease concerns as well.
I remember a few years ago, there was a horrible report about a motorcyclist on the Merritt Parkway in Fairfield County going along, and a deer jumped out and basically hit the poor guy off his bike.
Yes, there isn't much protection on a motorcycle, obviously, and those situations usually don't end well.
So is this problem, as you look at it now, because it has gone down in number, is the problem going to get better or worse in the near term?
Andy could probably answer this better than I can, but the number of hunters in state are aging out, and not many people are coming to replace them. So hunting takes on the order of 10 to 15,000 animals off the landscape annually in Connecticut. So with fewer folks available to do that, I would assume the population is going to creep up, and then, you know, the biggest source of mortality will likely be vehicles.
Andrew Labonte, do you want to join in?
Yeah, sure.
Scott was saying that you probably would be a little bit more qualified to answer that question.
If they're going to get better.
Is it getting better or worse in the near term?
I mean, as of right now, we've been looking at population numbers as far as hunters in the state. We've been relatively stable. We're certainly seeing a slight decline. So with different changes in management is kind of how things have been going in the state, and the reason for the decline in the last 10 years. We've opened up a lot of new opportunities, especially in those deer management zones 11 and 12 that I was mentioning, where essentially the majority of the population, we keep track of road kills. Police officers and such fill out forms every time a deer is struck by a motorist, and they send them in to us. So we had been keeping track of that information for a long period of time. And in that Fairfield County area, the number of deer vehicle accidents exceeded the number of deer harvested. And through some changes in management, where we allowed the use of baiting, we gave hunters extra tags to kill female deer to increase that additional harvest. We've now flipped that completely around, where we're harvesting significantly greater number of deer, and just over 100 or so vehicles are being hit by motorists. So by allowing these opportunities, by giving extra tags out, even though the number of hunters may be declining slightly, if a individual hunter is allowed to take many more deer than they had 10 years ago, certainly we can offset some of that with these minute changes. We also seen in recent years where we're now...
Andrew, give me one moment. I have to take a short break, but I'm going to let you finish that thought as soon as we get back. Andrew Labonte is with us, also Scott Williams, Laura Simon, and Mike Tessitore, Hunters for Deer. We're talking about the deer population across Connecticut and on Long Island. We'd love to hear from you. Email us, tfs@wshu.org. This is The Full Story. We'll be right back. Right now, we continue to talk about the deer population. And I cut off, just because we had to take a break, Andrew Labonte, who's a wildlife biologist at Deep, Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Andrew, I didn't mean to be rude. Please finish your thought.
Nope, that's perfectly fine. Understandable. So, I mean, we've increased a lot of opportunity for hunters and hunting. Some of the biggest things that we face now is really educating the large landowners and, you know, getting those folks that own numerous amounts of properties to realize, you know, in order to certainly manage the landscape, you need access. And obviously having hunters on the landscape and getting access to the deer is a huge constraint, and especially a lot of these areas in Fairfield County. But over time, we've obviously broadened that. We're on a lot of MDC properties, and a lot of folks are coming to us because they are concerned, not only just because of the deer and the consumption of the vegetation, but obviously, as Scott was mentioning, an extreme concern about Lyme disease and ticks and various other tick-related diseases, water quality. And as mentioned, obviously there's a change in the landscape of vegetation over time. The deer have a huge impact on the type of species that are regenerating, and typically they're not the type of species that most people want to have on their understory and have limited impact on those overgrowth species because they consume them as buds when they're trying to grow over time. So as Laura mentioned, there's obviously multi-prong approaches that we need to take to address a lot of these deer issues. And certainly hunting by itself isn't the sole answer. You need to utilize that in conjunction with many other tactics, because hunting isn't going to impact certainly issues that are created downtown, very close to the urban centers. Obviously, you got to take a different type of approach to that. And, you know, if you have a small garden, we always recommend fencing it or spraying vegetation that's, you know, around your landscape. So certainly hunting isn't the end all, but certainly is the largest way we can manage the deer population in the state of Connecticut and in most states in the country.
With that in mind, let me bring back in Mike Tessitore with Hunters for Deer out on the island. Mike, how many deer do you kill per year, do you think?
I mean, the average hunter and any number of hunting deer management programs for Suffolk County specifically, you know, we're only shooting 10% of the deer population. You asked about numbers before to one of your guests in Connecticut, and he actually gave you a number, which I was shocked to hear, because it's not about how many deer there are. It's about where the deer are coming into conflict with people and the environment. And I think that's important to note, because deer aren't spread out evenly. So when you have areas where that are coming into conflict with deer, you know, if you see indigenous plant species being destroyed, and you can see through the understory that there's more than 30, 35 deer per square mile. So, and biologists will tell you, it's not about the number, it's about where the conflicts are. And to say hunting is, there needs to be multi-pronged approaches, it's interesting to me, because while I do run a management program, we're management hunters, we're not recreational hunters. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that we have with hunting being effective. You need to change the mindset of the recreational hunter to take the management of the local deer population into their hands. That means instead of spending the 6 days a year that they may be able to hunt, that they're not going to just sit in a stand and pass all the does and wait for two big bucks to go by. My program is very specific. You have doe families that stay on three or four properties, and those are the four or five deer that are coming into conflict with those homes. If you remove those doe families, those people are going to see instant and a significant relief until another doe family moves in. But as long as you get access which your last guest, Andrew, just mentioned, access is everything. You can't compel a property owner to give access for hunting, nor can you compel a property owner to give access to do PZP or a sterilization program. And those are important things to realize, that unless you change the mindset of hunters to be management hunters, hunting will not be effective.
Mike,
but to say that we're going to sterilize deer and let them go, they're still going to walk around sterilized, eating plants, getting hit by cars, and carrying ticks further distances.
Mike, before I bring Laura Simon back in, what do you do with the meat?
All the meat that we take from the deer is utilized for human consumption. And it's a real feel-good program to hear that, you know, meat's being donated to the needy. And you know, that's great. But, you know, most of my hunters take the meat for themselves, for their family, for their friends. And you got to realize 75% of hunters are unsuccessful, so they always take the meat too. So all the deer that we take off of our properties also are available to our homeowners.
Laura Simon, wildlife ecology consultant. You've heard a lot over the last 15 minutes. Any specific response to what you heard?
Well, a couple things. People have a lot of misconceptions about Lyme disease, and they think if you kill deer, you reduce your risk of Lyme disease. But the reality is that the tick that causes Lyme disease is found on over 100 hosts. Primarily, the immature ticks will latch onto small rodents like white-footed mice and chipmunks. And unless you're going to be able to control the numbers of these small rodents, which is virtually impossible, you cannot control the spread of Lyme disease by plucking out one host deer, because what happens with this tick, it's a very opportunistic tick, it will switch to other hosts and congregate in higher numbers when deer are removed. So by taking out deer, you are really doing nothing to control the spread of Lyme disease, because those ticks are out there, they're on multiple hosts, and that's not going to diminish their numbers enough to reduce their own reproductivity and reduce them. So killing deer to reduce Lyme disease is not a viable method, and that's got to be put out of the way, because the science does not support it. But people tend to think that if less deer means less Lyme disease, and that's not true. Here's a big problem I see, is that in the suburbs where people are encountering problems with deer and conflicts, deer are eating their gardens, you're not going to have hunting there. You're not going to be plucking out deer. And quite frankly, if you have one person who's got roses or flowers of interest to deer, even if there is one deer in the area, that deer is going to come and take advantage of that buffet. You can't control deer problems by killing deer. It doesn't work. What you have to do is go to the source of the problem and eliminate what's attracting them. Reduce the food, change the food, make it, you know, plant deer-resistant varieties of flowers and ornamentals, spray your flowers with proven repellents that really work. Some are better than others. Do some barrier fencing. I mean, protect what's of value to you, and that's how you live with deer. You don't coexist by trying to manage their numbers, because what happens with deer is they're very adaptive, and when you knock back the deer population, they pop back up because they have reproductive responses. They will have a higher reproductive rate, they will breed at a younger age, and you'll see their numbers pop back up quickly after hunting season. So you kind of see a yo-yo effect. You knock down their numbers with hunting, they pop back up. It's not a solution. It doesn't work. And, you know, that's where I hate to see science misused in terms of saying, yes, we can control deer conflicts by hunting, because we haven't seen it work to date. And, you know, we need to help people realize there are other solutions.
What's your response to those who, and I have neighbors who've done this, so I can speak from personal experience. They have fenced in their properties. I mean, you know, big fences, eight feet high or so.
Right.
And I have even had some neighbors suggest, you know, we should just take the area and put a big fence around it, you know, a block or so, and because that's the only way that we're going to keep the deer out.
Well, if you put up an 8-foot woven wire fence, you are not going to have deer, even though they could conceivably jump that height. They don't. It's not worth it to them. I am fully supporting fencing that which you want to protect. And if you want to do a property or multiple properties, if you want to keep deer out, that is the proven way to go, and you will not have deer on your property. So yes, I'm fully supportive of that in addition to planting things that don't attract deer. I mean, the whole approach to living with deer and all other wildlife is remove what's attracting them to limit the conflicts. Don't try and manage their numbers because they're adaptable and their numbers will keep bouncing back. You kill some, they bounce back. You kill some. There's something called sustainable maximum yield, which is a management concept, which is how many animals can you take out and guarantee that they will bounce back by the next birthing season. And with deer, you can take out a good proportion of their population and know that they're going to bounce back, because reproductively, when they have more food, they have maximum reproduction, and boom, you see high survival rates in the fawns, and you have a bounce back effect. So that's what you're up against when you try and manage their numbers. So we say far better, protect what you value, and that you're going to be far more successful.
I was reading an article last night, and I remember one of the lines in it. They said deer are very simple. They eat, they make babies, and that's about it. Scott Williams, associate scientist at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station's Department of Forestry and Horticulture. It sounds, from what everyone is saying, that this is something we're going to have to struggle with for quite a long time.
Yes, deer are persistent. They're smart. They do have a lot of babies. And yes, it's going to be something we'll be dealing with for a long time. And, as Connecticut gets further developed, you're having situations where you're someone who wrote in was saying it's a very dense residential area, no place to manage the deer, and the deer do just fine and have no fear of humans. So that situation is going to become more and more frequent, unfortunately.
Mike Tessitore, how do you see the situation developing over the next few years out on the island? Do you think what you're doing is making a difference now?
I'm just amazed that we didn't start talking about carrying capacity. Laura talks about deer coming into people's yards, and that's why they're going there. And that's true, because basically there's nothing for them to eat in the empty woodlots that are next to those yards, because we developed them. So we have plenty of food for these deer, where the average deer eats 6 pounds of food a day, and a small plot of woods that would normally hold 2 or 3 deer in it now can hold 20 or 30 because we keep, introducing new plants to supplement their nutrition. So fencing, I was shocked that someone supported that, because people feel as though fencing pushes deer into the roadways, and then they get hit by cars. So do we have a long road ahead of us? Absolutely. And the best way that any property owner that wants to, look to reduce conflicts with deer or any nuisance wildlife, they have the option of reaching out to me at Hunters for Deer and having a hunter on their property during the regular hunting season, or they can get a deer damage permit to reduce that conflict.
Andrew Labonte, we're wildlife biologist at DEEP, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. We're coming to the end of the program, about 3-4 minutes left. Final thoughts from you, sir?
Pretty much as with anything else in life, you can't go at it with, one simple thing. So we know hunting itself won't solve the problem. It has to be in conjunction with obviously a whole host of other things. And you have to look at it not just as, deer eating all the vegetation, the potential for disease, participating in the life cycle of the tick, because we know that nymphal ticks don't necessarily have to feed on deer, but adult ticks need a large adult meal to feed on, which happens to be most commonly deer, obviously, in the woods. So they play some role in that aspect and transfer of Lyme disease onto humans, and their close proximity to residents on the landscape, obviously, especially when they're feeding in people's yards. So we know we got to use a different variety of techniques. We have to use some type of management, whether it's hunting or culling, in conjunction with protecting certain areas, whether that's through fencing or spraying. We don't advise fencing large areas off with 8-foot high fencing, because everybody would do that, around the state if they had that kind of money. and some do.
I've heard those proposals.
Yeah, I mean, so you have to use a whole host of different things, and not everybody is going to welcome fencing. Not everybody is going to welcome hunting. It's more educating the folks on the landscape as to this is what type of things need to be done. This is how you need to educate yourself more. Go to the DEP website. Go to other websites that you know are going to be useful for you. Go to the Lyme Disease Foundation websites and get information there. So you got to really educate yourself as much as possible so you can really make the most informed decision you can make based on how you feel and your, you know, morals about whether taking an animal for harvest. We're humans. We grew up on the landscape. We're part of the ecosystem, just like the deer and any other species out there. So you got to really educate yourself. And if that's something that you want to pursue, certainly we encourage people to do that. Go out there and actually harvest your own animal. There's nothing that feels better than going out there, pursuing an animal, and actually consuming it that you were a part of and involved in, and also helping, you know, either your neighbors or a motorist that might happen to be driving by that could be unexpectedly, you know, get involved in a deer vehicle accident. So that's, you know, there's a lot of different things, and nothing's ever simple when it comes to talking about deer and deer management.
Laura Simon, wildlife ecology consultant, you are going to get the last word today. We only have 30 seconds, please.
I just say there's a lot of non-lethal tools you can use to protect your yard and your home, and we encourage you to look into repellents, alternative plantings, certain kinds of fencing so that you can live compatibly with the deer in your backyard.
Laura Simon is a wildlife ecology consultant, formerly with the Humane Society. Scott Williams, associate scientist and certified wildlife biologist at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station's Department of Forestry and Horticulture. Andrew Labonte is wildlife biologist at DEEP, Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. And Mike Tessitore, Hunters for Deer. I thank all of you for spending a few minutes with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's it for our show today. Joel Schrock is our engineer. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari, Carrie Frank is the digital editor, Ann Lopez is our producer, and Terry Sheraton, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.